Page 130 of The Unfolding is the story of Ben Fuller.
I spent most of my youth trying to get my father's approval, and I didn't know how to earn it. You know, I was captain of the football team. Just, I was popular. However, you know, what they couldn't see on the inside was I was just completely empty. There was a huge hole, and I didn't know how to fill it.
God's story has been unfolding.
Since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in The Unfolding.
Hey, this is Meredith Foster. Ben Fuller is a singer and songwriter that maybe you've heard on the radio. He's just beginning his career in Christian music. But his story began growing up on a dairy farm in Vermont. He was a well-liked kid, and on the outside, seemed like he had it all together. But on the inside was an emptiness that left Ben searching, trying to find something to fill the hole. And he tried lots of things, relationships, alcohol, eventually cocaine, even quote unquote making it in the country music industry. And just so you know, part of his story is a brush with suicide. With each new thing, he was left asking himself, is this it? Is this what life is all about?
I was born in a small town called Claremont, New Hampshire, Valley Regional Hospital, and then brought quickly over the Connecticut River to Vermont. And this image of me getting paddled over there, but that's not the case. My dad was a dairy farmer, and my mom is a first grade school teacher. And so I was brought up in that household and raised very quickly on hard work.
Yeah.
So,
what is a typical day like?
We had 175 or so Holsteins. It was a well-respected farm for Vermont. Work before school. There were some chores before school and chores after school and in between.
What age did that start?
I don't know. I have pictures when I was probably 5 years old sitting on the lap of my father and tractors and, you know, going out with him. And I was his little buddy. You know, so he would just bring me out and show me how things work. And, milk cows twice a day, every day. So 5 and 5 is when, you know, chores would start at 5. And I guess it would probably be roughly 4 or 5 hours of chores
a day
in the morning.
Oh,
you know, so it'd probably be 3 to 4 hours of milking and cleaning and stalls and feeding. And then, you know, work in the fields in the afternoon and then, you know, stop at four and out to milk again at 5.
Was faith any part of like your background or your...
Vermont is 2% Christian.
Yeah.
And I went to church for funerals and weddings, and that was it.
And that was pretty typical for the people that you knew and were in community with?
Very typical. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't grow up with... the name of Jesus was not a common name unless it was, you know, used derogatory. Hmm. And that was how I grew up.
So... were you a happy kid? I mean, what was childhood and growing up like for you?
Childhood was extremely, I really held it together on the outside. And it was one of those things where, you know, I was captain of the football team. I was popular. A lot of people loved me because I was friends with everybody. And it was just one of those things where I just love people in general. Mm-hmm. However, you know, what they couldn't see on the inside was I was just completely... empty. I mean, there was a huge hole that needed to be filled, and I didn't know how to fill it. And so I spent most of my youth, you know, trying to get my father's approval. It was one of those things where it was passed down from my dad to him that as men, we don't show emotion. As mm-hmm. men, we don't show weakness. We don't show vulnerability. And my dad had a hard time showing that. And so there was a lot of times where I got the silent treatment. There was a lot of times where there was a lot of argument, and I became so scared of my dad. And I just wanted approval, and I didn't know how to earn it. So 16 years old, I had a gun in my mouth.
Oh.
And I was ready. I was ready to die.
Did anybody know that was going on? You talk about being able to put on this front. anybody know that you were in that kind of a place?
I've been spent a lifetime at hiding things, spent a lifetime at being able to just stuff it down.
Yeah.
And not let anybody know what was going on with me. I was ashamed. Mm. And I didn't want people to have a different view. I was embarrassed, to be honest.
Embarrassed that you were so unhappy?
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. And so it was like, I don't know how to say it, you know? And so all that built up inside of me. And, you know, there was just one day that, you know, I walked out back and behind our farm and, you know, carried a rifle and I was really close to doing it. But it was like, you know, that cliche saying of let life flashes before your eyes, you know, and you go through some, you know, some of the people maybe listening or some people that I've talked to have been through it. And it's like, man, it does flash. And so I saw my funeral. I saw the line out the door. Mm-hmm. I saw my mom finding me. I saw all the things. And I was like, the gun just fell from my hands. And
thank God.
I was so embarrassed, you know, and I was so confused and so mad. I just remember crying uncontrollably and just not knowing what was next, you mm-hmm. know? And that, I stuffed that down and I didn't tell anybody about it. And I didn't know how to share that. It, mm-hmm. You know, it's taken me 17 years to share that. And 2 years later, I got, you know, 18 years old is when I got introduced to cocaine. My good friend that started a love relationship.
Did that seem like relief to you? I mean, did cocaine bring relief?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It brought numbness. It brought
numbness. That's a good way to say it.
All the things I could just hide away, you know, I could run away, but feel nothing. Hmm. And, so that was extremely dangerous for me because I just fell in love with it and it became my best friend.
At 18, did you leave home? What did your circumstances change to?
So I hid it so well. So I could party on the weekends and keep my life together during the week. And, you know, after high school, it was like, well, Ben's got to do something with his life. And I really enjoyed landscaping. I love stone wall building. And so I had those trades. And so I went to school. I went to college for landscape architecture. I loved it. It was amazing. And it was a hands-on. It was a 2-year school degree. It was all hands-on. It was really amazing. And I learned all about trees and shrubs and plants. And but I was drinking uncontrollably up there, you know, and I would spend the weekends up there. And I'd ride around with friends and we'd just drive around, drink and drive all over the place. And rural Vermont, I mean, it's back roads and, you know, so it was fine, right? I mean, it was one of those things where it's like, yeah, we're not going to, we're not going to hurt anybody. This is nothing. We can do this. So that was, you know, and I did it and it's like, it became the normal thing because it's cool and I fit in and along came smoking weed and all the things, you know? And so I was able to, I never considered myself an addict. Ever.
Wow.
I never looked at this because I said, I can pick it up and I can put it down. Addicts are bad people, right? They're bad people.
Right.
I'm not a bad person.
I'm not that person.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever put it down?
I put it down during the week. Yeah, absolutely. And then I would pick it up on the weekends and that was my justification. I could also put it down for, there was times where I'd drop it for a month or drop it for 2 months or drop it for 3 months and then pick it back up again and then drop it for, you know, however long. And so that was how I justified in my heart. Mm-hmm. I was like, I'm good. I'm great. I'm fine. But I just remember the hangover was just the worst. And I felt so guilty and felt so awful and was just like, I'm never doing it again. You know how many times I've said that? I'm never doing this again. Ever. Ever.
Right.
And then the next weekend would show up and I'd do it again. And so that cycle was unbreakable.
Did it have an impact on your relationships?
Absolutely. I can't tell you the countless relationships of women that I've been in. It just led to complete brokenness. And I met some absolutely wonderful, extremely beautiful women. And it just was like, I was so searching for love and for affection, you know, and what I got was an empty bed the next morning. Mm-hmm. And I was alone. And it constant seeking, you know, and I never got that, like, and it wasn't the girls. I was saying it wasn't the relationship. Those relationships weren't the relationship that I was looking after, that I was trying to find.
Ben's search would take him from the bars of Vermont to the bars on Broadway in Nashville. Part two of his story is coming up, but first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. Almost every day you see a headline about a leader who has done something corrupt. Where do you think we tend to go wrong in our leadership journey?
Yeah, we are. I mean, it happens all the time around us. And there are some good people that don't mean to go wrong. And there are other people that are just like that. You know, they end up being in leadership. But even the good people that go wrong, I think popularity, notoriety, celebrity kind of gets to your head. It's not really a 21st century thing. Read the Old Testament with that in mind. You just see how many people got into power and got into, became the king maybe, and then they abandoned God. But my example for the lay people, don't be a hero worshiper. We're all human beings. We will all fail. But if God is our hero all the time, and both the speaker and the leader and the layperson looking up to God, then things happen and we can go through it. So both guarding our hearts as leaders is the responsibility of the leader, and the layperson not to treat the leader as a hero or as a god. You know, that's what foreign gods are like. Sometimes we put people up as a god. Mm-hmm. So don't have a hero syndrome.
If you want to learn more about humility in leadership, Habib's website is a great place to do that. It's HabibHabib.com. And now the rest of Ben Fuller's story.
I spent my whole life, and stonemasonry is my, that's my trade, you know.
So you started working in that field?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I got a job right out of college. And when I look back on it now, I built walls my whole life. Physical, strong, beautiful stone walls all around me. And it was like, I felt so empty. And I remember feeling, you know, the families, you know, I built some really, had some very beautiful homes and stuff. And the families would come up and, you know, maybe sit on the wall for a 4th of July evening and watch the fireworks and then pick up their stuff and load up their kids and go home. And it was like just that little bit. And I was like, is this what I'm doing this for? There's got to be something more for me. There's got to be something more for me. I was building these beautiful walls. I was doing all this amazing work. And I still felt like, is this it? And I remember asking myself that, like, throughout growing up, is this it? Is this what I'm supposed to do? I secretly felt inside that there was something bigger. I had no idea. Mm-hmm. No idea what it was. I was like, is this it? And the answer was no. This isn't. Like, this isn't where you're at right now is the stepping stone. No pun intended, but that's, you know, I realized that there is something more. So graduated college in 2007, got a job immediately out of college, started working for a landscape architect, extremely prestigious, wonderful, wonderful man. I met who is now my best friend, who has been my best friend through this, Paul. Paul had been a believer his whole life. And I remember being with him and he never once threw the Bible at me. He never once told me to stop. He never once, because I would come in hungover. I would come in still messed up. And he knew it. And he never once ever called me out on it. And we would have talks about faith, little talks about faith here and there and stuff. And it never, but it's just amazing how it just brushed by. And it never really quite set in. 2009, I met another best friend. His name was Ryan. We just crashed into each other. It was an amazing thing. We got introduced through a friend and his father's a logger. He had issues with his dad too. And so it was one of those things where I was like, okay, wow, we can really get along. We had so much in common. And then I found out that Ryan had an infatuation with cocaine and, you know, had been one of the largest drug dealers in that area. And so Ryan and I moved in with him. Every week we could work 60-hour weeks. You know, I was working really hard. He was working really hard. And then come Friday, we'd text each other and, yeah, let's go pick up some cocaine and let's party. Let's have a good night. And we did. Years went by with that. Probably until 2014. We lied to everybody. My job kind of took me to some different places. It took me to Miami, Florida, Florida Keys. Again, I became a really just good stonemason. I became really good at building walls. And so I got noticed by a family that lived in Miami and they had a house here in Vermont and up in Vermont. And they asked me if I'd like to come work for them in the wintertime down there. So I went down and built beautiful stone walls out of coral 40 feet from the Atlantic Ocean.
Wow.
And so I spent a couple winters doing that. And so during the summers, I had met a girl by the name of Caitlin. And it was all over a puppy, which is crazy. But I was needing a friend again. I was trying to fill that void. I was like, I need something anyway. I was like, I should get a dog. I'm living by myself. I'm in and out of relationships and everything. So I'm like, I'm just gonna get a dog. And so I'm drinking a bunch, you know, all this stuff. But I'm able again. I don't look at it as like I don't have a problem.
I'm functioning.
I'm fine. So I went and picked out this puppy and also met this beautiful girl. And so I got a girlfriend and a puppy in the same day. And it was like the most amazing thing. It was about a month into our relationship and found out that she had a problem with opiates, that she was snorting pills. We were on our way to meet my parents. And she said, I need to tell you something. So she told me that. And she said, I need to snort a pill before I meet him because I'm really nervous. And I pulled over and I let her. After we left, I was so angry, but I was like, is there anything else you want to tell me? She said, well, I have some cocaine in my purse. And I said, well, then break it out because we're going to do it together. And started this year-long relationship of using crazy, drug-filled, just broken-hearted emptiness running the other way. And just it was the most beautiful and awful time of my life. She got pregnant and lost the baby. You know, it was one of the most difficult things for me to wrap my mind around. So I knew the whole time, again, here comes this thing, that I was made for something more, that something is calling me. I had no idea. Inside, I was like, is this it? Is this my life? Is this what it's going to be? And not long after that, 2016, Caitlin threw me out of her life. And she just said, I can't do this anymore. Get out of here. She went down this extremely dangerous path of drugs and being used and trafficking. And just, it's just really awful stuff. And I picked up all my things, and again, I was trying to find my place. I was looking for home. I bought a house, and I got my old job back as a stonemason and with a beautiful landscape company that never went anywhere. And Paul was right there again, and he welcomed me back with open arms. And, you know, I was doing great, $40 an hour. I was making all kinds of money, and I had picked guitar up in college. And so I was playing a little bit, campfires and things like that. And all of a sudden, 2017 rolls around and I get a phone call from my best friend's sister, and she just cried. And I realized that Ryan was dead. He had just gotten out of a rehab facility. He was fine. Like, they fixed him, you know. I didn't realize that he had graduated to heroin. I had lost touch with him, you know, for a while, and we had kind of got separated. 2 weeks after he got out of rehab, He relapsed and overdosed. You know, when I got that news, I didn't know how to take it. I kind of went numb again. And you would think something like Ryan passing away would straighten me up, would change my ways, would make me see. But that didn't happen. I remember going into a spiral, drinking and still using, and so many lonely nights wasted by myself. 15 beers, 16, 17 beers, just... And I would go to bed and I would wake up and I'd go back to work and I'd come home and start drinking again and I'd go to bed and go to work. And it became this cycle. And after losing Caitlin and after losing Ryan, I remember one night I picked up my guitar and I started writing feelings. Things started coming out of me. And that's what really started 2016, 2017, like in that area is when I really started writing about my feelings, really started journaling and telling the truth. But again, I was so, it's like, is this it? I've got this little house. I'm in here. It's a beautiful house. And I'm alone. I've got a beautiful job. Is this where it ends? You know, is this what my life is going to look like in the beautiful state of Vermont?
In any point along that way, you're journaling, you're writing, is there any time when you thought about God or asked God a question or cried out to him in any, you know, did that ever cross your mind?
You know, I'd like to say yes, but I spent a long time talking to myself, but I suppose I was talking to him the whole time. And I really didn't understand it. Nobody ever explained anything. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever told me. And so I had a friend call me who I had met years previous, and she, Selena, and she said, hey, are you doing anything with your music? I said, no, why? You know, what do you mean? And she said, you got such a beautiful voice. You should really start singing. You should start singing out. And I said, well, that's kind of silly. I don't have time for that. And she says, no, really, you should think about it. Like, I'll help you make a Facebook page. I'll help you create some stuff. And so she did. So she hopped on, she started creating things for me. And all of a sudden it was like, well, I'm going to reach out to a couple local pubs up there where you are. She's in Maryland, mind you, which is crazy. But anyway, so she started calling these local pubs and And they said, sure, we do live music on this night and this night and this night. So my first show ever was February 25th, 2017. And it was a little dive bar named Sherry's Place. And it was in the basement and the place was packed. There's people everywhere. I had a music stand in front of me because I was so nervous with lyrics on all the cover songs that I was singing. I think I made like $350 that night. There was cash in my guitar case. It was amazing. And the most dangerous thing about that whole night was the fact that I had about 12 beers lined up at my feet because people were buying me beers and shots and all the things because they loved it. Because the more that I would drink, the more that I would sing. I drove home really drunk from that show again and again and again the next weekend. And so I was working 60 hours a week, doing my work, doing my stone walls, doing my landscaping, planting trees, building this beautiful relationship with all these bars and these people, and people were coming out and the word was spreading and Vermont and New Hampshire, and it was like, yeah, Ben's going to play here, so we're going to go out, and hey, Ben's going to play here. And I was drawing families out. I was drawing people out. It was really amazing. I met a lot of beautiful people.
Did it fill that void in some way?
In some ways, I think between the drinking and then the music, and so I was able, I think the music for me really was this outlet, mm-hmm. and it became to like, I could feel things, and so I would sing Chris Stapleton's song mm-hmm. Fire Away or something. I could mm-hmm. feel, man, that made me feel. It was able to be this outlet for all my emotions. And then between the drinking and the women and all the stuff, I still was like, is this it? Is this maybe what I was looking for? And the answer was no. Again, I was like, what else? You know, I've got a beautiful job. I've got a house. I've got, now I've got this music career that's like starting to build. And so people started whispering, hey, you should go to Nashville. And I was like, Nashville. What is that? You know, I've heard of Nashville, but never traveled much ever. And so you should go to Nashville. So I started hearing it. So almost in spite of everybody else, I was like, you know what? Fine. I'll go. I'm done. I'm like, I'm done hearing about it. I'm done. I'm just going to go. I'm just going to do this. I'll show you guys. We can do this as a state. I'm going to show Vermont, make Vermont proud. And I'm going to move to Nashville. And so I worked all summer 2018. And I said my goodbyes to the crew and Paul. Fall of 2018 came around, I called my realtor and I said, I want to sell my house. And she said, you're crazy. You just moved in there in 2016. Like, what are you doing? 2 years. I said, well, I'm moving to Nashville. I'm going to do music. Well, that's even crazier. But all right, whatever. I'll make some phone calls. The next day, I get a phone call from her and she says, hey, she said, you're never going to believe this, but I've got somebody that wants to see your house already. I said, oh, wow, that's amazing. I'm at work. Sure, you can show it. So she showed it that day. She called me that following night and she said, Ben, you're never going to believe this, but the woman that wanted to see your house just put a full price offer in.
Oh my goodness.
$210,000. And she's from Nashville, Tennessee. And I said, really? I was like, what a coincidence. Uh-huh. I was like, that's a coincidence. Okay. Wow. It just was just the beginning of this whole craziness had just started right there in that moment. So I sold what I couldn't take. And I packed what I could in my truck and I drove down to Nashville, Tennessee.
What did you think was going to happen when you got there?
I was going to be a big star.
Okay.
I guess. I don't know. I kind of had this thing. I'm going to do it. You know, my heroes, Vince Gill, and I can do it. And boy, when I got down there, that was a different story. And I remember pulling into town and going, this is crazy. And I stayed in an extended stay hotel in Madison. And I remember locking myself away. I remember locking myself away in there and drinking for like 3 days. And just drowning myself and be like, this is crazy. I should go home. This is crazy. I should go home. I had a friend reach out, Taylor, and she said, you got to go to Tootsie's. You've got to get down to Tootsie's on Broadway. They'll hire you. You're good. They'll hire you. 2:00 on Saturday. So that weekend, I went down there. It was like a Monday or Tuesday when I moved down. That weekend, I went on Saturday afternoon, 2 p.m. And I got up on stage and I signed a little clipboard and put my name down and I was just sweating bullets. I was so nervous. I was like, this is crazy. I've never experienced anything like this. People everywhere. Everybody's drinking. I remember having a couple of beers to knock the nerves off. And I got on stage and I sang Queen of my double wide trailer and I just let it rip up there. Sammy Kershaw. Then I sang David Allan Coe, The Ride. And it was like, that was my story. This little man in a booth up there. Well, what's everybody think of Ben? And all of a sudden everybody just started, just erupted in applause.
Yeah, we love you. Yeah.
Well, looks like you're hired. We'll see you tomorrow morning, 10 a.m.
And I'm like, tomorrow morning is Sunday. Like Sunday at 10 a.m.?
Yes, sir. We'll see you Sunday morning.
And so I started the next day and I lugged my guitar down there at 10 a.m. Tootsie's opens at 10 a.m. The live music starts on Broadway in Nashville at 10 a.m. Wow. And so I lugged my guitar down there and I started playing.
What did you feel when the crowd went crazy and he says, you're hired?
Oh,
what did you
feel? This is it.
This is finally.
This is home. Here I am. I made it. Like, this is, I made it. I remember calling my dad, sending him a picture, calling my mom, calling home, because they were like anxious to hear about what had happened. I'd never really reached my dad's approval. And so I was like, I'm going to tell him I made, you know, this is. And so I sent him the picture and I called. I said, Dad, they hired me at Tootsie's. He put it on. My dad lives underneath my mom's alias, for anybody listening, on Facebook. He goes by, Dave Fuller goes by Candy Fuller on, you know, so my mom hates it. Anyway, so I remember my dad getting on my mom's Facebook and being like, Ben made it. He's working at Tootsie's. They've hired him. He's playing the big time. He's playing the Strip in Nashville, Tennessee. That was it. Oh my gosh. To hear, to just know, I when I saw that my dad had posted that and he was so happy. And I was like, man, awesome. Even though he didn't directly say to me, I'm so proud of you for getting the thing. I'm so amazed. I love you. He didn't say any of that. It was just like, wow, awesome. You're like right down there with the stars and everything. Awesome. You know, feeling that joy from that. Like, hey, dad's happy and he's proud of me. That went on for, I guess, almost close to 10 months. And I lugged my guitar down there. And so from 10 a.m. till 2 p.m. or 2 p.m. until 6 p.m. And it was 4-hour shifts. They pay $10 an hour.
Oh my goodness.
And so you get $40 for 4 hours. And sometimes during the winter months, they would put you on the third floor at Tootsie's. And hardly nobody would come in because it was freezing cold or it was just dead at 10 a.m.
How are you paying the rent?
So that's how the beautiful relationship I created in Vermont, New Hampshire, with all the people that were supporting me, I would go home. I'd be down in Nashville for a month or two, and then I'd go home for a weekend or two.
And make some money.
And I would make some money. And these bars would now, you know, Ben made it, quote unquote. And so now all of a sudden it was Ben Fuller from Nashville. And so the signs on the, you know, at the pubs and all the things with Ben Fuller from Nashville, home from Nashville. And it was one of these things where I was selling t-shirts and it was amazing. People were coming out to support me and they loved me.
Did you feel better about yourself in life at this point?
Oh my gosh. I mean, and this is where I didn't have a connection for cocaine. And so that part of me had slowly, I didn't realize this, but slowly started dying off, had slowly started leaving. And so the drinking was crazy out of control, but I didn't have that connection down there. And so that was one of those things where, I just don't need it right now. I'm good. And so I kind of started weaning off of that. But I made some of the most beautiful, incredible friends in Vermont, New Hampshire that would come out and support me and love me. And still to this day, still, and I hate the word fans, but friends mm-hmm. of mine mm-hmm. that still keep in touch and everything. And so, yeah, I would go home to pay the bills. And that went on for just about 10 months. So at this point, I was driving home in the afternoons on 65 South, just drunk. And I remember several mornings, just, you know, I'd have to hit my key fob on my truck to, you know, let the horn blow to figure out where I parked my truck the night before. I have no idea. The situation was just continuing to snowball into this one word, tired. And I had just grown tired of running, tired of operating underneath my own power, tired of waking up next to somebody who I barely knew. Again, I asked myself this question. Is this it? Have I made it? Is this what making it is? And so I started going home more. I slowed down on Broadway and I kind of gave up and started going home more and booking more there and spending more time at home. And this was leading into the fall of 2019. And so I'd come back down to Nashville. I was trying to gather my thoughts. I was so tired. I was so empty. I was so sick of drinking. I mean, I'm drinking every night. And I get a phone call out of the blue. It's this family from Vermont that God had sent down to Nashville, Tennessee, a year and a half before I even moved down there. I had landscaped with their son for a short season, so I knew their son, Derek. They said, hey, we know that you don't know us that well, but we're here, and we'd like to know if you want to come to dinner. And I said, I am sick of ramen noodles. Sign me up. And so I was so tired. I was so broke. I was so just like, okay, anything at this point. So I go over there and it's a beautiful house and I sit down and have the most beautiful meal. And they said to me at the end, would you like to come to church with us in the morning? And I said, yeah, can you pass the rolls? Like, sure. And I love people, you know, so it's one of those things where, sure, I don't even know what this means, but I'll spend some more time with you. And to be perfectly honest, And I'm sure they're going to hear this because they love me dearly and I love them even more dearly. But I think maybe a little bit of me was being polite because they just had me in this beautiful meal and all this stuff. And I was kind of like, a little bit of me was almost like, I owe you. And that piece inside of me of like wanting to give back to them, I was like, sure, I can't say no to you now. You just filled me up. The next morning, 9:30 in the morning, Church of the City, 3,000 people. And this is going into the winter, 2019. I remember pulling in the parking lot, seeing all the people, and we walked through the doors and that the men, the women, everybody's beautiful. They're glowing. They're smiling. They're waving at me. They're talking to me. And I'm going by them. I'm like, wow, everybody's super nice here. Like, what is going on with this place? And we're just passing all these beautiful people everywhere. And I'm like, what is going on? And all of a sudden I get to this point and I just hear, and I see the auditorium doors and they're wide open. And just like a magnet, I just remember, I got to get in there. And I just walked in and I stood in the aisleway. Chris McClarney and John Reddick were leading worship. And I'll never forget how I felt. And I just stood in that aisleway and I had no idea why everybody's hands were up. I had no idea what was going on. I remember hearing, I gave you your voice and now you're going to sing for me for the rest of your life. And I just remember being like, okay, I'm done. I'm done running. I'm done. Do whatever you want to do. This God, this man I keep hearing about, I have no idea, but I'm just done. And from that point on, he just started taking away the things that I thought were important, that I thought mattered, that I was using to fill me up the whole time. The this is it things that were never it. And he pulled the language out. I used to swear so bad. And he pulled the sex out and the drinking and driving and all the things that I used to cover up and to fill up. And there was no need for any of that anymore because I'd found it. It was one of the most beautiful and also completely devastating moments of my life because I'm like, wow, I was so filled up. But everyone started noticing. And they're like, what's wrong with you? What's the matter with you? Like, what's going on with you?
Like, who was saying that?
I had so many friends that I partied with, that I hung out with. They noticed I wouldn't swear anymore. Like they noticed all of a sudden I'm, hey, you want to have a beer, man? I'm good. Huh? Like, bro, what? And I remember it was really a shock to a lot of people. What do you mean Ben's sober? Like, what do you mean Ben's doing? Like, what's going on? Actually, I had, you know, a group of friends kind of have an intervention with me when I went back home.
Almost like a reverse intervention?
Yeah.
Like, how come you're not drinking
anymore?
Yeah,
literally. You know, and they just kind of were like, hey, we love you and we think you're being brainwashed. This church thing isn't really you. I remember I'm a people pleaser. I am such a people pleaser. I remember being like, yeah, you know what? You're right. You're right. You know, it's weird. It's a little different. I'm never going to lose the country music though. I'm going to keep doing country music. Thank you. And I remember walking out of there, you know, after this party and being like, I can't, like, I know what's right. I don't care what they say. I know in my heart, I've changed and I'm better than I was. And I had this peace about it, you know? So I was like, I'm okay. And I didn't realize that all the things, and are you kidding me? After all the loss and all the drugs and all the nights that I woke up and all the nights I didn't go to bed and all the things, it's like, nobody's going to persuade me now. Nobody's going to pull me back after what I've been through. I'm done.
How long was the period of time? You walk into that church service, you have that overwhelming experience.
Yeah.
So what was the, in terms of your transformation?
Yeah. I mean, 2 months.
Oh my.
It's a crazy thing.
It is pretty fast.
It was a crazy thing. I gave my life and got baptized November 10th, 2019 is when I came out of the water, just like a freight train. And I said, God, here we go. I don't know what this looks like. I have no idea. I don't understand the Bible. I don't understand this whole thing. I don't really understand you. I have no idea, but I know whatever this is right. And it's way better than anything I've ever done. I started feeling things. I started writing things. My writing changed. I started writing about love. I started writing about light. I started writing about Jesus. I started writing about things. So my manager, you know, the girl that started my Facebook page and all that stuff, Selena was like, I can't do it. I don't understand this Christian thing. I'm out. And so she left. I was really alone. I was really like, what do I do? I had to get out of the situation I was in living. I had to get out of all these situations. I had to kind of figure out, you know, I'm changing. Got this little gig at a smoky bar in Nashville. And so I'm going in there and I'm like, I'm going to sing about Jesus in here because that's what I'm doing now. I go in there and I sing about Jesus, and there's a girl sitting in the very far back, and her name's Crystal. And I get done playing and I walk up, put my guitar away. She was kind of sitting where the cases were stacked. And she leans over and she goes, "Takes a lot of guts to sing in a bar like this." Like, wow. She goes, "I'm Crystal. I'm a believer and I'm from New Hampshire." And I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "I'm from Vermont." And we're like, "Haha, you know what? This is crazy. Okay, God." And so what she hadn't realized is I had just given my life to the Lord not long before this, month and a half or whatever prior. So we exchanged numbers. And long story short, in a month, she had a Google Calendar set up for me. And she goes, "I think I moved here for songwriting, but I think I'm supposed to help you with management. Like, I don't know. I'm supposed to help you. I'm feeling like God says, be his friend, be a manager." Now, mind you, I haven't had a whole lot of girls that were just friends with me. And so this was a huge thing. This was a different thing for me as I'm wrestling with that also. And because celibacy started. And so all these things started.
Dude, you are, it's almost like for your very cells are changed. Like everything's changing in such a short amount of time. It's awesome.
And so all these things happen, all these changes happen. And Crystal was like, "Well, let's work together." And so I'd made some music and we put out an album. It was really country and it was Christian. In the middle of all that, it took me 17 years to write it, but the song Other Plans, I brought it to these producers and we recorded it. It was really powerful, but it was about my brush with suicide. Crystal really liked that song, and so she said, "Hey, I think I'm gonna take a really big shot in the dark." So she sends my song Other Plans to this guy named Neil Spielberg. He worked for Warner for 20 years, was on the road with Randy Travis, Faith Hill. He's very, very extremely well-respected in all of Nashville. She says, "I'm going to shoot off the hip. We got nothing to lose." And puts her number at the bottom and says, "Hey, you don't know me." But 3.5 minutes later, he calls her back and says, "I don't know who this guy is, but I believe him and I want to meet." And so all of a sudden, oh my gosh, she calls me. She says, "Oh my gosh, we got this meeting with this like really big guy." And COVID hits. Boom. And I'm like, "Oh Lord, what am I going to do now?" You've opened all these doors, all this stuff is happening and the world shuts down. And so remember Paul, I call Paul and he knows he came down for my baptism. He told me he'd been secretly praying for me all those years as a landscaper, all those years of building walls. He was secretly praying for me as I was with him. He says, "Well, everything's shut down." He said, "But we're still working. Why don't you come home?" And so I went back to work with Paul and now we're fellowshipping and we're talking about Jesus.
You're doing landscape, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so the music world, everything shut down.
Yeah.
And so at this point, so I go home and I work landscape again. But this time it's different. Paul and I can talk about Jesus. Oh, talk about an encouragement, just lifting me up. And we were getting into the word and we were going. It was amazing how that changed everything. All these things led up to this moment. I'm just like, okay, I don't really know. You know, and the world didn't know what to do, you know, what was going to happen. Well, during this time, as I was up there working, Neil and Crystal were phone calling and emailing and setting up this network, everything from business managers to record labels to booking agencies. And so when I came back down in the fall, things kind of started opening up a little bit. There was kind of a window. And so I got done landscaping and moved back down. They had all these meetings set up. And so they walked me right into these record labels, these Christian record labels, started meeting at all these places. And the first thing I heard was, "You're too country for Christian and too Christian for country. Change your voice. Try to adapt to Christian radio. You know, good luck." And the second meeting that I took, Blaine Barkus, A&R for Sony Provident. And he looked at me and he said, I told him this story right here over breakfast. And he said, "You're too country for Christian, too Christian for country, but I love your heart. There's something really special about you. And I'd like to give you a couple of co-writes. We'll see what happens. We'll see what songs come out of these rooms." About song number 50 comes and Blaine calls me and I'm driving. He says, "Will you be part of our family?" He says, "We love you." I just remember pulling over and being like, not only do I have Jesus now, but I'm being offered a record deal with a major label. So I was like, wow, God. And I just remember thanking him so much for all the things I've been through. Mm-hmm. So 116 songs.
Wow.
In 7 months. And it's just unbelievable how this whole thing led up until now. So here I was. And so I signed with Sony Provident 2 years, 6 months, and 11 days clean and sober, sitting here looking at you. And Jesus saved my life. And it wasn't until I said yes with my mouth, but I believe it wasn't until I said yes with my heart is when he could really do something with me and really change my life. And I could really step into my calling and who I am. God knew I needed an anthem. He knew I needed a declaration for how my life had changed and how to explain to everybody. And so I'm a child of the Most High God, and the Most High God's for me. And so the song, Who I Am, he just gave it to us. I just want to tell my story. I just want to tell the truth. And so that's just what I'm out to do, is just tell the truth and to encourage people to tell their story, because nobody can ever take that away from you. And it's the most, you know, the blood of the Lamb and the word of our testimony, it's the most powerful thing ever. I've just been able to do just that. God has been sending me the most beautiful people. And not that long ago, he sent me a young boy who, after I sing that song, Other Plans, everywhere I go, that little boy stood in line. He got up to me and he looked me in the eyes and he said, you know, the first song he played, he said, I was having those thoughts this week. He said, I'm 16 years old. My name's Nathaniel. And I sat there and I said, thank you, God, because I'm talking to the 16-year-old me right now. And I've got the answer. And his name is Jesus. And I prayed over him and I hugged him and held him and told him what I didn't know when I was 16. And that's what God's allowing me to do. And not only that, but he's coming after my dad. He's coming after my mom.
How did your dad take it? When you shared with them that this whole Jesus thing, how did that go over?
Does every song have to be about Jesus?
That was his question.
That's what he said. That's what he said, yeah. Every song, Dad.
It's going to be a lot.
Every song, Dad. Every song's got to be about him, because that was it. That was the it. That was him. That was who I was looking for my whole life. God put me in the room not that long ago with a man, Casey Bethard, who had lost his son a few years back. And Casey's one of the best songwriters. I was in line to write with him. And the day came with him and Jonathan Smith, who produces all of Zach Williams' music. And I sat down and Casey looked at me from across the room and he said, how's your relationship with your dad? And I just started crying. And God had put a man, a father, who had lost a son, and a son who was looking for his father, in the same room, and out came the song Proud. So fast forward, probably 6 months, 7 months, about 3 months ago, I was in New Hampshire at a church, and there's about 400 people or so, and in walks my mom, and in walks my dad, and in walks my sister, and my nieces. And they sit down, and I got up there, and I sang my songs, and it got to that song Proud. And 2 hours previous, I was praying in the nursery, because those are the green rooms in churches.
Yeah.
And I was praying in the nursery, and God showed me all these images of my dad throwing rocks, and yelling, swearing, slamming the door, me standing at attention when he'd walk in the room, terrified. And then everything stopped, and he showed me this vision of my dad standing up in a crowd at a church, walking to the altar. And I said, yeah, right. Yeah, right. And I wiped my eyes. I didn't even realize I was crying, but I wiped my eyes. I stood up and was getting ready to go on stage. There I was. Fast forward to that fifth song, and all of a sudden Proud came. The room's full. The first lines of that song, he never hit me with his fists, but he did some damage with his words. My old man didn't know no better. He just passed down what he thought worked, and I was already crying. And the Holy Spirit moved so mighty in that room. I was able to get the song out. And I turned, pulled a strap off my guitar to set my guitar down, because I said, I'm going to go hug my dad. And I turned around and my dad had stood up. And he was already halfway down the aisle. And he was coming to the altar. He was coming to me. And he hugged me. And he said, you were made for this. And the thundering applause and the people stood up. And that moment, my dad told me he was proud of me and that he loved me. My whole life, I'm 35 years old, was looking for that. Making my father proud looks a whole lot different now.
If you'll stick around to the very, very end of the podcast, you're going to get to hear Ben sing that song about his father. It's called Proud, and you might want to have a tissue handy for that. Ben has a bunch of concerts this summer all over the U.S., and then he's headed out on tour this fall with Zach Williams. You can find out when he'll be near you and check out his music and more of his story at benfullerofficial.com. Thank you, Ben, for sharing your story and your music. Hey, do you know somebody with a powerful God story? Head over to the Unfolding Podcast Facebook page and tell us about it. And while you're there, you can actually check out a video we recorded with Ben while he was in the studio. Thanks to the Unfolding team, producer Jason Rackow, Elena Nowlin, Danielle Perez, and Jennifer Brisky. Also, our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. You can find out how Habib can share inspiration and motivation at your workplace at HabibHabib.com. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll be back next week with another page of The Unfolding. And now, Ben Fuller and his song, Proud.
He never hit me with his fist, but he did some damage with his words. My old man didn't know no better, just passed down what he thought worked. I tried and tried to break his pride and be the apple of his eye. And maybe I was loved, but he never let me know I was making my father proud. Looks a whole lot different now. It ain't about the man that I call dad, who I can never figure out. It's about knowing whose son I really am, and knowing he's my biggest fan. It's the kind of love that makes my world revolve around making my father proud. Got a long road to live and learns in the rear view of my life. But somewhere in the crash and burns, in those wrong turns, I saw the light. He kissed my face, I felt his grace. He said, my child, you found your place. And I fell down on my knees. I looked up and I could see I'm making my father proud. Looks a whole lot different now. It ain't about the man that I call dad, who I can never figure out. It's about knowing whose son I really am, and knowing he's my biggest fan. It's the kind of love that makes my world revolve around making my father proud. Me and my old man finally settled old scores. 'Cause pleasing this world just don't matter no more. Now all I'm living for is making my father proud. It ain't about the man that I call dad, who I can never figure out. It's about knowing whose son I really am, and knowing he's my biggest fan. It's the kind of love that makes my world revolve around making my father proud. Making my father proud. That's what life's about.